So it's lovely to see you guys here again. Last time I was here, many of you were here. And you're going to plant a tree today, is that right? Well, it's a gorgeous day for it. Nice and warm, which is unusual here. My son spent his first 4 years here, and we lived against the hill. And every day he would get up and we would take our cold shower because we had solar heating. And then he would run around Green Gulch, which was great as a kid. And one time I found him eating large handfuls of the compost pile. So I don't know how you live or how you live, but it was very exciting to him. And you know, they say that kids, maybe some of you younger kids actually feel this now and you older kids can remember, but they say that about a year old, you're much too old for that, but at about a year old, kids start being afraid of strangers. So before then, anybody can pick up a baby and it's okay, but after then, kids start to learn vibes, I think. So my son, who lived here, was about 60 people. All those 60 people were fine, but a new person would come in. Ah! So it's strange how many people we think are family and then who a stranger is. So there were three boys who lived here at the same time that my son did. My son, Ethan, he was the youngest, and then Micah and Kelly lived here, and they, all those three boys, spent their lives together, their bedtime stories together, their meals together, and their snacks in the afternoon together. So these snacks were very important because all the boys watched more than what they got, they watched what each other got. You wouldn't do that, would you? So there were always three cookies and three apples or three bananas, whatever it was. So every day around three, they would have the snack. Do you guys have snacks? Do you have a snack at your school? What is it usually? What kind of snacks do you guys have nowadays? This is like 30 years ago or something. Banana and pear? Orange. Oh, yeah, we have oranges, too. What do you usually have?
Saltines and guppies.
Saltines and?
Guppies.
Oh, guppies, right, the little fish. Right. So we didn't have saltines and guppies, for sure. Every once in a while, somebody would bring in those little cheese cracker fish. Those must be the same as guppies, right? But we call them a different thing. Goldfish, right. And those were like prize because they were from the outside. So anyway, things went along fine with three apples and three bananas and three cookies until one day a new little boy moved to Green Gulch, and his name was Sean. And Sean had lived in the city and was now moving out here. So the person who brought the snack only brought three cookies and three apples. So what should they do? There were four boys, three cookies, and three apples. Do you have any suggestions for how they took care of this? Should they all not eat at all? Should three of them eat and one not? What do you think? You didn't think that was a good idea, did you? So how do you divide it up? Ask the teacher. What should they do? Yes. Oh, okay. And how do you think they should figure out who should eat the apple? Volunteers?
The poor should eat the apple.
She'll be a very good manager someday. Any other ideas? So what do you think they actually did? Any ideas? No pressure, no pressure. Well, what they did is they cut the three cookies up into lots of pieces. And then they cut the apples up into lots of pieces. They cut the cookies into so many pieces that the kids couldn't count high enough to make sure that everybody got the equal amount. So do you think that was a good idea? What should they have done? Oh, you wouldn't like it if somebody cut the cookies up into that many pieces? Well, do you think that everybody should have the same amount? Maybe I'm just assuming. Should everyone have the same amount? Do you like to make sure in your snack time that everybody gets what they need? That's important. Do you usually get what you need at snack time? There's usually enough to share and go away satisfied. Do you worry if somebody doesn't take enough? Yeah, you seem like you might. So, these three boys grew up and eventually left Greenville. It's actually fairly early. I think Ethan was about four or so when he left, and we moved to the city. And guess what they're doing now? I'll tell you. A chef. Actually, one's not far. They're in their early 30s now. I think 31 or 32. I'm not good with time. 32? Okay. Micah. Oh, you're two. I got it. You're two. Yeah. So you have 30 more years to go before you're as old as Ethan. So Micah, the oldest, he lives in Sebastopol, which is about an hour north or an hour and a half north, and he runs a construction company with his dad, Ken Sawyer. And they design beautiful handmade houses. I mean, a lot of the houses are handmade. And Ethan has worked with gang kids in San Francisco for many years, kids who need some help. And where's your mom? Oh, okay. And Kelly is a wine. What is it when you know a lot about wine? Sommelier in Spokane, Washington. So, go plant a tree, you guys. Thank you very much. Enjoy your time here. so patient. Actually, it's just by coincidence that I've often been here to give a talk on the days that are children's days, and I always think of myself as someone who just doesn't know kids, doesn't know how to get on with kids, and so I'm always impressed when these kids are so patient. You know, they just sit here for a long time. I mean, it must be at least 20 minutes or something by the time I get in and they leave. That's a long time for a kid. I'm just impressed. And a lot of it must have to do with the atmosphere in here that the adults hold, you know, that container. Because when our kids were little, like babies here, they were expected to keep silence at meals, which is about 10 minutes or so. And they would start as soon as they were off the mother's breast, you know, coming to the dining room and keeping silence. And so they were removed whenever, I mean, just taken to the kitchen to eat in their high chairs, whenever they made noise. So by the time they were 2 and 3, they were absolutely silent for that time. And I used to take Ethan and at least one of the boys home with me to Ohio to see my dad. And, you know, so that Ethan would have someone to play with. They were always at least 2. And my dad would take them to restaurants, and they would just sit there. The other kids in the restaurant were climbing over booths and chasing each other and tripping waiters. And, you know, and Dad would just, God, he was proud. He said, "I don't know what you're doing to these kids, but it's great." I also had told them that they couldn't use any bad words in Ohio. That people in Ohio didn't use bad words. And so if one of them ever said anything, you know, the others would say, "You're in Ohio, you can't talk." So, for many years now, I've been exploring body awareness and its relevance to healing. Healing from a physical trauma or from some great emotional upset, maybe a single event or an ongoing tragic event, or having to live your life with some huge loss that will go on forever. Like the health of your body, or the death of someone that you loved, perhaps a child, which I don't think any parent would ever recover from that, really. So this is the kind of thing, a body awareness and its relevance to these situations that I'm most interested in and that I've studied over the years. So this having to live with grief and pain for the rest of our lives applies to all of us to more or less degrees. So for several months now, a number of practitioners and I have been studying the body's point of view in great detail and in intimacy. Small groups of people up at our house, our temple, the Russian River Zendo, or at Vajrapani, a 5-day sesshin, but over a period of time, since last fall maybe, I and various practitioners have been really exploring this issue together. And so this subtle realm is a realm in which the body and mind cannot be clearly differentiated from each other. So which are we training when we sit? Body or mind? So does compassion come from the body or the mind? See what I mean? I mean, basically, this is all mushed up together. Love, anger, we don't know whether they belong to the body or mind if we're interested in splitting them up. So this is a realm in which there's no question. You can't split them up. And so basically, this is all I feel competent to teach, really. The body and its sensations is our basic mindfulness practice. And our awareness of body-to-body intimacy, our primal sense of each other and the myriad things, body-to-body with each other and all the myriad things of our world. This body-to-body business with things and beings is our basic comfort and joy. It's the basic reason we would consider living in pain, continuing to live through grief and loss. So practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, which are form, body, stuff you can see in the body, feelings, consciousness, and stuff, phenomena that you consider to be outside of your body, wherever you draw that line. These are essential. The basic mindfulness of these four things are as essential to our development as upright and wholehearted human beings as air and water. They're that important because you cannot challenge the overriding dominance of greed, hate, and delusion, of gaining mind without the stability, without developing the ability to focus on the details of the present moment that only a disciplined mind can manage. So all meditation practice is to shift you out of appetite-based reality into breath-based reality, present moment reality, experience-based rather than concept-based, to bring you to now. And what is now but body sensations and sense impressions, awareness of your thoughts as thoughts, and all the stuff going around that we can see and touch and have contact with. So when our teachers tell us to be mindful, that's what they mean. That's what to be mindful of, is those things, body sensations, sense impressions, thoughts, feelings, and stuff. So there are countless, timeless, and boundless sensory experiences to be had. And we have them continually, all the time. It goes on. But we tend to focus on our understanding of things rather than the raw sense data. So mindfulness of the details of this present moment enable us to stop blocking immediate experience in favor of those concepts about it. So when you allow yourself to experience the present, the floor doesn't stay a floor. It doesn't stay flat and even. People don't stay in their cubbyholes. I always recommend that people married a long time or who have friends for a long time look at that face as if they've never seen it before. When I look at my husband's face, I see a kind person. You know, he didn't have that face when I first met him. I mean, it had other qualities to recommend it, but when I see what it's become, it's so much fuller than that sexy man with the long blonde hair. So we want this. We desperately want this connection on this raw, unmediated level, but we're terrified of it. all of our education has been to cultivate respect for and reliance on for our concepts, our reasoning brain, to plan for the future and avoid any mistake that will sully or threaten that future. So we're afraid to let go of our minds and rely on what? What? That's so scary. So even though our teachers encourage us to practice nowhere standing, we resist such a terrifying idea and cling instead to the tenets of Buddhism, creating just another dead idea to hold on to. Like the dead ones we so bravely gave up in order to practice in the first place. So we sustain a meditation practice in order to get comfortable with what is really happening, the chaos of feeling, the riot of perceptions. Meditation fosters the stability that enables us to bring forward in trust and without fear, or with fear, actually, a reality that we already know somehow through the wisdom of our body, but it's habitually overshadowed by our cravings and our fears. So this morning, I'd like to discuss that somehow knowing, the wisdom beyond wisdom that we participate in through our body, that unless we're aware of and trust, we cling again and again to our thoughts, our concepts, our opinions. So this, I feel, is the core of trusting. This is not self-acceptance exactly, though it certainly partakes of self-acceptance. But it's much bigger than self-acceptance. It's not having a particular self at all. Not so you don't have anything to accept. It's just raw experience. So from my point of view, as a person who counsels people who have chronic pain that won't go away, or people who have experienced catastrophic situations, everything important to them was swept away by circumstance. Tapping into what I'm talking about, this wisdom beyond wisdom, is simply how to survive. When we have nothing left to hold on to, we must find comfort and support in the mundane details of our everyday lives, except that they're not very mundane once you observe them closely. We call this suchness. This is called suchness. The shining uniqueness of beings and objects when you don't have any particular attachment to them, any particular agenda going in. Suchness. The uniqueness of this particular thing. So it's the upside of impermanence. I think of it as the good thing about impermanence is this suchness, that this thing that's manifesting right now is distinctly original and unduplicatable. This thing, this person's expression on their face, when I look at you after I blink, you won't be you to me. So for example, I just sat 3 days of a sesshin in a city center, and this is the first time that I have sat a sesshin without leading it for many years. So I just sat, hour after hour, period after period. I just sat. So I don't know if everyone here has sat for long periods, for days at a time like that, but I'll just briefly describe the setup. It's set up so that you have almost no preference whatsoever. So that you can't indulge any preference whatsoever. The food is pro forma. Unless you can show pictures of your x-rays of your stomach, you're going to eat the food that is made and served. clothes, there's very little choice. You're asked to wear dark colors, and it's to your advantage to pick out comfortable clothes for the time and take them with you. So people layer, you know, for the cold of the morning and night, and then the warmth of the afternoon. So you'll just take the same clothes and a change of underwear. And the companions, the people that you'll spend time with, are chosen. Just as your seat is assigned, the people next to you are assigned. So you're going to be with people you didn't choose to be with. And as far as your activity, that is strictly defined. You're going to sit, and you're going to work, and you're going to eat, and you're going to have very little free time. And during that free time, unless you have a private apartment, you are going to be sitting or standing with great dignity. You are not going to be lying down in public. So the activities also are strictly dictated. So the preferences is minimized. Now they do serve gamasio with the meals, sesame seeds and salt. And there, I mean, I amused myself for days. Sometimes I'd sprinkle this bowl, sometimes this bowl, sometimes not at all, sometimes everything. So I could do that. And I could choose the color of my hair tie every day. And which pair of underpants I was going to wear. My husband said, you women choose underwear? You choose which under... I said, of course. You know, it depends on what color the other thing... Anyway. So there was some operation of preference there, but basically it's not happening for those days. So when preference fades, as you sit, when preference fades, what comes forward then is the myriad things, all the things inside and out of you, and it's quite arbitrary by that time what's inside and what's outside. So there's just, on Page Street, there's traffic noises, big cars, little cars, noisy motorcycles, putt-putt type vehicles, people's conversation, the time of the morning, the doors opening and closing, click, click, click of people's shoes on the sidewalk. And then inside the zendo, there's coughing. Coughing from deep down in the chest or coughing, you know, up in the throat. And people's footsteps walking by. And so all these things, you know, I know that zendo in the city so well, the little rivulets of paint that have dried. And I saw a particular rivulet. I'm very familiar with this corner because I sit in a chair. You know, a part of the rivulet had been chipped since the last time I sat there. So this is what comes forward. You know, all these myriad things in great drama and great dimension. I almost felt like they were coming forward to play, shimmering with their suchness. Needing me every moment. And finally, they stopped needing me and just were me. They defined me. So you realize every form is Buddha. Not just flowers and trees, but also beer cans and microwaves and dust bunnies in the hallway. They're all Buddha. They're waiting for our embrace all the time. The world of suchness, and this is my particular interest in it, the world of suchness is a deeply healing world. For instance, I know well a practitioner who lost his ability to function in an accident while still a young man, just after earning his master's degree in engineering. He was never able to practice his profession. And for years, many years, all he could do was lie down. His back was in such excruciating pain. In fact, and he spent most of his time on the ground, you know. But after a while, when he accepted that this was his life, he would go to social occasions anyway. His kids PTA meetings. Hi, how are you? And so people got used to his doing this. In fact, he had prism glasses so that he could relax his head and see the way we see. So he by now he's led about half his entire life on the floor. And he, you know, has everything set up so he can use the computer. Although his arms get tired, you know. Well, he has gotten so much better through the years that he now goes to a gym to exercise and strengthen his muscles. He's just started being able to do this after years on the floor. I mean, he still spends most of the time on the floor, but he is going to the gym. So for months at a time, going to this gym, he's worked out along able-bodied, strong men in a macho atmosphere. So this practitioner would actually be quite macho if he could be. This is his temperament. So it's been extremely painful to him to be lesser than, to be ignored or stared at at the gym. But the reality of the situation is that ever since he started going there, he has always focused on the difference between himself and other men there. They are strong, he is weak. They're fully functioning, he's inadequate. They are fulfilling their potential as men, and he is not. But then one day, for no reason that he could locate, he slipped into what he and I call the flow of the universe, the flow. Reality based on breath rather than on concepts. And he suddenly saw himself and the other man as not two. He was deeply nourished and encouraged by this sudden disappearance of duality. No health, no sickness, no strength, no weakness. Just his physical activity and his body-to-body sense of other bodies in the gym room that he was in. Just this. It thrilled him to his bones. And that was when also, incidentally, he realized that he was the one doing the differentiating. So he went home after his workout and came into the usual tumultuous household that has two kids in it and his wife, and his two daughters were fighting and his wife was yelling at them. He says this happens quite a bit when he goes home. And so he always stands at the door and announces that he's home and that there should be quiet now. Since, you know, people in pain have, it's hard for people in pain to tolerate a tumult for one and loud noises for another. It's too much sensation when they have bodies already overwhelmed by sensation. So usually he tries to quiet them all before he even moves from the door. But this time, he just stood at the door and took it all in. He felt his way into their energy level, and then he entered his home like a child enters an already skipping rope. You know, you've got to have some perfect timing, and then you just slip in. So again, he was deeply nourished and included. He was just part of what was happening. No high energy, no low energy, no noise, no silence, no exclusion, no inclusion. Just this. So for me, this is already deep trusting. What kind of faith does it take to trust this moment enough to settle it into it and forsake every other moment? What kind of incredible faith does that take? There's no longer any issue of adequacy or competence or achievement. There's just this, entering the world as it is with all its ornate and confusing detail. And much of this detail is inherently healing, supportive, therapeutic. Whenever I enter a room, I look for its support. Pleasing lines. The light coming in. Natural objects, handmade objects, since they have a lot of vibration. They're inherently more supportive than objects that aren't handmade, but that doesn't mean that plastic isn't supportive. It is. It's just handmade objects have a lot of going on a subtle level. So this is what our environment holds. So you can choose to take the body's point of view, which that's what I'm describing, for a few hours a day, a few days a week, a few months at a time, a year, or a more or less permanent point of view for the rest of your life. I encourage you to try it as an experiment. At the very least, you'll increase your mental agility by going back and forth between your body, your goal-directed thinking, and your sensations and sense impressions. You may find that cerebral functions actually increase and become clearer and more functional as you pay attention to the body. And that is because you'll have a stable, reliable point of view from which to judge your possibilities. The body gives you this. The body has a very simple outlook compared to your ego needs or your conceptions. So it's very stable that way. Even a painful body is very stable compared to the mind. So when people feel settled in their bodies, they frequently experience a clarity and a certainty that's very helpful in arranging the priorities of our complex life and our complex world. So I've had various theories about practice throughout the decades of my practice life. The first theory I had when I first began sitting as a young woman was that it was all magical. You know, if I could just sit there, if I could just get my rear end on a pillow and sit there, the universe would just take care of it. You know, I'd just be struck by lightning, be enlightened. And so that was my first theory. And then my second theory, that didn't pan out. My second theory was that I had to discipline my mind. And I did many practices from the Abhidharma. I used to actually walk around Tassajara counting dharmas, counting when I perceive something. Well, you get up to, you know, past when you want to count in a few minutes. So I had to give up that practice. And then the third theory I had was that practice was a matter of balance. You know, that you would sit for a time and exercise for a time. Do something for other people for a time and do something for yourself for a time. Be solitary for a time and be with people for a time. So I was always, you know, gauging how to, and you know, my innards, my emotional life actually was complicit with this, because if I did something for somebody else for long enough, I would be pushed back in the other direction. I want time for myself. I want this or that. Or, you know, we have rhythms. And so it seemed to be complicit with that, with the rhythms, my own rhythms. And I congratulated myself that I had been able to discern my rhythms over time. So I had that theory for a long time, maybe a decade or something. And then then my next theory was that practice was about self-acceptance. If I could just accept with dispassion every tiny little wart on my personality, every cruel thing that I did, every self-interested train of thought that was carried out again and again, if I could just accept all that about myself, then I could relax, at least relax. But I don't think that's what practice does either. I don't think that's practice either. So I'm back to the magical stuff. I'm back to, well, I'll just sit. What else can I do? I have no idea what's happening. And I think that's good, because knowing myself, if I did know what was happening, I for sure would interfere with it. So practice develops other parts of us than our cognition. Lots of things develop your cognition, so don't waste practice time with cognition. So I've come to suspect, I tend to think now, my current theory for teacher-student relationship is that this, the most important part of this is nonverbal. The most important part of teacher-student communication is nonverbal. So this hanging out aspect of teaching has become very important to me. The most important thing to me at this time in my life. My son is raised, my grandson is nearing adolescence. So finding interesting ways to spend time with other bodies is very interesting to me. It's the most important thing to me. Especially bodies which are shaped by intentional hearts. Hearts with intention. Bodhicitta. Way-seeking mind. So this is the true transmission to me. Drinking tea face-to-face. Sitting body-to-body. Going over rapids next to each other in a raft. I know this is a very unique priest training program, but it works. The Eno at Tassajara now, Joan Amaral, went rafting with me last summer as part of her post-ordination training program, and she was afraid of the water, she told me, after we got off the plane. We went down the Salmon River, and she, you know, her job was to roll up the sleeping bags while more experienced people loaded the rafts every day. And she helped with quite a bit of the cooking. And then the time came, after some days, that she was asked would she like to go in one of the kayaks by herself. So, you know, that's down right on the water instead of up in a raft. So she did, even though she was terrified. And so she met her first rapid, you know, and paddled through it, getting splashed and everything. So she told me, now that she's, you know, at Tassajara, she said, whenever we're about to do a big ceremony and I'm in charge, I've never done it before and it's so scary, I think I just meet the waves. Just meet the waves. So this is the true transmission. Things are being processed and ripened. All happening within ourselves. So you hear a lot about effort in practice. And indeed, I believe it takes much effort to practice. But there's a lot of confusion about where the effort should be applied. And I'm not sure that we should make great effort to sit night and day for months at a time. I know Bodhidharma did it, so I don't want to cast too much aspersion on it. But it's not my way. Or psychic theatrics, like bending a spoon or something like that. I'm not sure that learning how to do this kind of thing is beneficial for practice. I think it's actually building a tolerance for plain old boring mindfulness. For instance, students come to me all the time at City Center and say, I have tremendous talent. When will it be recognized? And I remember Joan herself, who's a wonderful student. When she was new and at City Center doing all the, you know, shit jobs and stuff that you do there. As part of your practice, she said to me, I've got more energy than these jobs take. I should be, you know, running a crew, or I should go to Tassajara or whatever. And I said, take that energy and put it into these jobs. Don't change what you're doing. Just do this with great wholeheartedness. Very disappointing. So now I have a student whom I hugely enjoy in the city. Again, tremendous energy and heart. And, oh, you know, she's just a dream of a student. So she's assigned 3 weeks in a row to washing all the those little window panes of the Buddha hall. She comes to me. Oh, God! You know, I'm doing these little panes day after day. They're clean already, inside and out. I have so much energy. I have so much talent. So I ask her, please take this energy and talent and make this job interesting. That takes talent. I sure know it takes a lot of energy to make this job, to make the mundane world, to bring it to the shimmering suchness. That's your job. The myriad things will come forward. So you can't watch this process. You can't notice wisdom while it's germinating. Measuring spiritual evolution is like watching yourself grow. You can't force your zazen. You need to trust the form and the process, to put yourself in it and be open to it. Allow it to unfold. Philip Whalen, before he died, used to be the head priest of Hartford Street, which at that time, very different from now, that time was very quiet, very few people visiting Hartford Street, even on their Saturday morning lectures. And so he told us when we visited one day, he said, actually, a number of students, usually out-of-town people, drop in on me, you know, during the afternoon, and they're delighted to find a bona fide Zen teacher here in this little place. They've heard of you know, Hartford Street in the Castro district. They've heard of it from, you know, even in Europe. So they say, well, how do you practice? How do we get started? And so he tells them, and they ask him about trances, you know, and bliss states, and mandalas, and chants, and bliss consciousness. And he says, well, just sit down. Just sit. And then they say, okay. And they come a few times, and then they disappear. He shrugs. It's so easy. I don't understand why people don't want to do it. It's so easy. So. Thank you very much. Attention equally penetrating. Being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. These are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be.